I next met with Dr. Kathy Miller, who, as commented on in the interview with Dr. Geyer, recently presented safety findings from a Phase 1-2 trial of the combination of the trastuzumab chemoconjugate TDM1 and the HER2 dimerization inhibitor antibody pertuzumab. Dr. Miller began by providing an overview of the rationale for this study.
Two new agents that are still in clinical trials that inhibit HER2 or take advantage of HER2 in very different ways. First is pertuzumab, which is created with very similar technology as trastuzumab, with the key difference being that it recognizes a different spot on the extracellular portion of the receptor. And that's important simply because it blocks homo and heterodimer formation. And trastuzumab can inhibit signaling, but it doesn't block the dimerization. So particularly, you could still get signaling through the HER3 axis with trastuzumab on board. And because pertuzumab blocks the binding of HER2 and HER3, you also decrease signaling through HER3. Now, some in your audience may already be thinking, but wait a minute, HER3 doesn't have an active kinase, so who cares about HER3? And that's true, but it has the most docking sites for the PI3 kinase. So if you've formed dimerization, you could still get activation and binding of PI3 kinase to the HER3 segment because you have activated HER2.
I've been hearing more about PI3 kinase and still not really understanding why it's so important.
Well, it's important because it's one of the first steps inside the cell. So if you've activated HER2 or HER3, you need a cascade of several other signaling molecules to be activated that drive particularly proliferation. And HER3 is the first of those. It can be activated by other tyrosine kinases and other receptors as well. So PI3 kinase is not important just in breast cancer. This is an area where multiple tumor types could be affected. And there are now PI3 kinase inhibitors that are in clinical development and have made the move into clinical trials. They're quite early in their phase one lifetime, so it's a little bit too early to know how successful they will be. But the early experience with directly inhibiting PI3 kinase has been very encouraging.
Now, we've heard a lot about TDM1, and maybe you can update us on what else is new or maybe stuff that came out at ASCO, but also on pertuzumab.
So pertuzumab was initially studied as monotherapy and then also in combination with trastuzumab. And in both cases, the patient population in those phase 2 studies were patients who had HER2-positive disease who had progressed on previous trastuzumab therapy. Response rates with monotherapy ranged anywhere from 10 to 20%, with another 10 or 15% or so of patients with stable disease. So that as monotherapy in trastuzumab-resistant patients was quite encouraging. There is now a large phase 3 trial in the upfront setting, the CLEOPATRA trial, that uses a docetaxel plus trastuzumab backbone and looks at whether adding pertuzumab to that would increase activity. That trial is moving along well, though its accrual is a little bit behind what had been initially projected or hoped for, so it may be some additional time before we hear about those results.
What about TDM1? Anything new with that?
Well, so TDM1 takes a different tactic. TDM1 essentially says, we're not going to focus so much on inhibiting HER2 signaling. We're going to focus more on using the unique expression of HER2 on the breast cancer cells as a way to deliver therapy just to the cancer cells. And if you recall, that was actually the original concept of antibodies. In the very early days of antibody therapeutics, there really wasn't a thought that an antibody by itself might do something. It was just going to be essentially the address label on your radionucleotide or your chemotherapy. So the key to TDM1 is the chemical linker, which binds roughly 3 chemotherapy derivatives to each trastuzumab molecule, with the idea that as the antibody binds to the receptor, the entire complex is internalized, and you release the chemotherapy directly intracellularly in the tumor cell. That should, in theory, allow you to get a much higher concentration of the chemotherapy into the tumor cell, which may increase activity. And it should also dramatically decrease side effects because you have much lower circulating levels.
And I know the encouraging results in far advanced disease with TDM1 have prompted trials, for example, looking at it compared to chemo trastuzumab, I think, as first-line therapy. What do we know right now just sort of indirectly comparing those two?
Well, we don't have data at this point in the first-line setting. We have data from 2 phase 2 trials in patients, all of whom had progressed on trastuzumab, and in the case of the second trial, patients had also progressed on lapatinib as well as standard chemotherapy. Response rates in both of those trials were about 30%, another portion of patients stable for a more prolonged period of time, and progression-free survivals of around 6 months with a very favorable toxicity profile. So that in the refractory patients has been very encouraging and really leads to the question of, do you really need to give systemic chemotherapy? So there were two large randomized studies addressing that question. First, in the previously treated patients, looking at T-DM1 monotherapy compared to the combination of lapatinib and capecitabine. And then very shortly, we'll be activated a first-line trial looking at a standard combination of taxane plus trastuzumab versus T-DM1 monotherapy versus a third arm of T-DM1 plus pertuzumab. So the phase 1 and early phase 2 study of T-DM1 plus pertuzumab that we showed the first data from at ASCO was really the lead-in and the support for that third arm of the study.
And can you talk about the data that you did present?
So the trial had two phases. A first phase 1 traditional dose escalation cohort. We found no obvious increase in toxicity, and we were able to escalate the doses of both drugs to what we would consider to be the standard phase 2 doses. The trial then expanded into actually two phase 2 cohorts. So a cohort of previously treated patients, and then a separate smaller cohort of patients who had received trastuzumab in the adjuvant setting or neoadjuvant setting, but had not received trastuzumab for metastatic disease. As you might imagine, that first-line cohort took a bit longer to identify the patients and for it to enroll, so we didn't have data from that group at the ASCO meeting. We had data for the first 28 patients out of the 44 patients in the refractory cohort. The toxicity looked very much like what you would expect from T-DM1 alone, some minor systemic issues of fatigue, some thrombocytopenia, though not associated with any bleeding or real clinical significance, and no obvious cardiotoxicity, though these patients had all had trastuzumab. Most had had lapatinib, and their hearts had sort of shown that they didn't particularly care if you inhibited HER2. Response rates were also between 25 and 30% in that refractory population, though with fairly wide confidence intervals because we have early data on the first 28 patients. So we were certainly encouraged by these results and by the lack of apparent increase in toxicity. While there is trastuzumab with T-DM1, the actual concentration of trastuzumab that you get is substantially less than if you just administered someone a full dose of trastuzumab. So the hope is that by adding pertuzumab, you would further dampen HER2 signaling. You would also pick up decreased signaling through the HER3 axis while still using T-DM1 as a way of targeting delivery of chemotherapy. And in preclinical systems, there's profound synergy between those two agents.
Has there ever been discussion about adding systemic trastuzumab to T-DM1?
So there has, but the concern is actually that if you overwhelmed all of the HER2 receptors with sort of naked trastuzumab, that might further decrease HER2 signaling, but it might also decrease uptake of T-DM1 and the chemotherapy moiety to the tumor cells. So without actually studying that, it's not clear if overall you would improve the results or hinder them.
Now, what about the thrombocytopenia? Can you sort of dissect out when it occurs, what the magnitude is, and what the thinking is in terms of the mechanism? I've heard people even speculate that it might even be some kind of sequestration thing. What do we know about it?
Well, so we know very little, or at least I know very little, about the mechanism. The timing in the patients who have thrombocytopenia is interesting and curious. It tends to come on quite early, often within just a couple of days of infusion. For most patients, it's fairly moderate, but there are some patients who have quite significant thrombocytopenia, dropping into the 20,000 range. But they also recover very quickly. So we've seen a couple of patients who started with 200,000 platelets. 3 days later, they're at 20,000. 4 days after that, they're back to normal. So it is sometimes quite significant, though acute and very short-lived, and thus far not associated with any bleeding issues. So I suspect that this is one that is going to get a lot of attention in the early clinical trials. And as the agent moves into practice and people get used to it, it will not be nearly such a big issue.
Anything else that happened at ASCO that you'd like to comment on? One paper I saw, but I didn't get a chance to go to, is I saw that Joyce O'Shaughnessy presented something looking at, I don't know, an overview of the bevacizumab trials. Did you see that? And what did she present?
I saw it. It's taken me 4 years to get them to do it.
I thought of you when I saw that.
Yes. And actually, it wasn't me that ultimately got them to do it. It was the FDA.
Interesting. So what happened? What was it?
Well, so one of the big questions is whether bevacizumab in metastatic breast cancer impacts survival. There's not been a survival difference in any of the frontline randomized trials, but with the caveat always being that each trial individually was pretty woefully underpowered to show a survival advantage. But there are now three or four of them, depending on how you count the Ribbon 1 trial, with about 2,500 patients total. So it was ripe for a meta-analysis to look at overall survival. So Joyce's presentation was really a meta-analysis of all of the efficacy and toxicity and safety results, none of which changed the message from the reports you've seen before of the individual trial. So in that whole presentation, there was one slide that was important and new, which was the overall survival meta-analysis. And there simply is no overall survival advantage with bevacizumab. The PFS and response rate improvements absolutely hold up to the meta-analysis, and there were no even rare toxicity issues that came to light with the meta-analysis. But what we were really missing was a properly powered assessment of overall survival.
So, I mean, this is something that you've been commenting on since you presented the ECOG study in 2005 up there on the stage with all the adjuvant trastuzumab people. What's new in terms of the way people look at these data and kind of what it means?
Well, I think people have looked at it in different ways depending on their goals for therapy in this situation and their concerns about cost and toxicity. And patients have looked at this in different ways for all of those same reasons. You know, we designed E2100 with progression-free survival as a primary endpoint from the very beginning because we thought that was the most direct assessment of the activity and the potential impact of the drug. Overall survival is clearly an important endpoint. I would never suggest that we don't want our patients to live longer. I'm only suggesting that overall survival is a composite that is partly driven by the patient's age and comorbidities. It's partly driven by the inherent biology of her disease, some of which may not be changed by the therapy that we administer. It's partly driven by toxicity and ability to get therapy. And it may, to a small extent, be altered by initial therapy. It may also be altered by second, third, or fourth, or fifth line therapy. So overall survival is a composite. So in essence, you have to have an even bigger impact of your therapy, particularly in the first line setting, to really see an overall survival difference. That's not really true for progression-free survival. It is much more directly tied to the impact of your therapy. Still can be influenced by toxicity and ability to deliver therapy. Still can certainly be influenced by the inherent biology of the patient's disease. But a lot of those other confounding factors that can come into an overall survival result don't impact PFS or impact it to a much lesser degree.
So I wanted to ask you, this year, are you the breast cancer program person for ASCO?
I'm the overall scientific program chair.
Okay, so I just wanted to put a pitch in and say I really love the new session that somebody did this year, the new trials thing, because we always like to talk about new trials. And there were a couple of these studies that were presented that you were involved with, which I was really curious about. And one, just to follow up our discussion about bevacizumab, but also a topic near and dear to my heart because I feel like it's been ignored forever, which is diet and exercise. So what about this ABCDE phase 2 study of adjuvant Bev, metronomic chemo, cyclophosphamide, methotrexate, diet, and exercise after pre-op chemo for breast cancer? Wow.
So we finally have an acronym that rivals one that you would see in colon cancer, where the best acronyms have come from. So this is a trial led by Erica Mayer at the Dana-Farber and will be conducted through the Translational Breast Cancer Research Consortium. It builds on a pilot trial of looking at antiangiogenic therapy in patients who had standard neoadjuvant therapy but still had residual disease at time of surgery. That's a population that every neoadjuvant study has identified as being at substantially greater risk of developing distant metastasis. The problem being, what do we do with them? And there really isn't anything that we know we could offer them that meaningfully improves their outcome. So they do sometimes get treated. They get treated with lots of different things, none of which you could point to any evidence to say that this is helpful. So Erica and her colleagues had led an initial pilot trial looking at safety of different antiangiogenic strategies in that setting. It was not randomized, so we couldn't really look at effectiveness. So this is a larger study. It will be about 600 patients, all of whom have substantial residual disease and therefore substantial residual risk of recurrence after neoadjuvant therapy.
And I remember Hal Burstein from that group had presented, I think it was Bev and the metronome of chemo by itself kind of looked pretty interesting.
Yes.
That was a while back.
So there were four cohorts in the original pilot trial. One cohort got just Bev by itself. A second cohort got Bev and the metronomic cyclophosphamide and methotrexate. And then there were two capecitabine cohorts looking at different dosing strategies. So this trial will look at two potential interventions, both of which there's some reason to think might independently affect risk of recurrence. So it's a 2-by-2 randomization, the first randomization being bevacizumab and metronomic cyclophosphamide and methotrexate or not. The second randomization is looking at a diet and exercise intervention versus just a diet intervention. And the diet and exercise interventions have as their goal decreasing saturated fat, increasing lean sources of protein, very WINS-type dietary changes. And the exercise intervention is specifically geared towards increasing aerobic exercise. And that's really based on cohort studies that have consistently shown that our patients who engage in the most aerobic exercise, either before or after diagnosis and treatment, have the lowest risk of recurrence. What's not known is whether changing someone's exercise pattern impacts recurrence, but there's reason to think it will. With some recent studies that looked at aerobic exercise interventions and then looked at circulating hormone levels and cytokine levels and found that the intervention resulted in a shift in those biochemical parameters to the levels associated with lower risk. So there's at least some emerging physiologic understanding of how exercise might play a role. But this is really the first adjuvant test of that concept, if you will.
So three words, I love it. And just, you know, it's awesome. I can't wait to see the translational stuff, which I think will probably, you know, it's not so much the diet, it's what's the diet and exercise really doing.
And the study includes a lot of biological samples.
Right.
To really see what changes
right.
do you get with this intervention and how do they track with recurrence.
Yeah, that's really awesome. The NSABP is about to do a trial with enaparib, formerly known as BSI-201 in the neoadjuvant setting. What about the post-neoadjuvant residual disease setting and PARP inhibitors? I've been hearing a lot of people talking about doing trials in that space. Anything actually happening?
We have shifted from talking about it to doing it.
Oh, good.
So we have a trial specifically for patients with either sporadic triple negative disease or known BRCA1 or 2 mutation carriers who have neoadjuvant chemotherapy, still have substantial residual disease at time of surgery. So the same population, particularly in a triple negative group, that's a group that has a huge risk of recurrence. And the trial will ultimately randomize patients to 4 cycles of cisplatin or 4 cycles of cisplatin with a PARP inhibitor. The PARP inhibitor will then continue for 6 months of maintenance therapy. The PARP inhibitor is one guided by Pfizer. And at the time we initiated this concept, there was not phase 1 data with the combination of their PARP inhibitor and cisplatin. So we have 2 phase 1 sort of safety run-in cohorts first. Hopefully next Tuesday, I will enroll the last patient in the first safety run-in cohort. And then once we get through the second safety run-in cohort, the randomized portion will open. And that's a multi-center study that will be available at probably, when we're all done, over 20 centers around the country.
Talking about triple-negative breast cancer, an email I just received yesterday popped into my head. People are always asking me to ask investigators about cases they have. And this one was a 43-year-old woman with a triple-negative, node-negative tumor that was 1.8 centimeters. The doc's question was choice of chemo.
Yeah, I'm giving her Dose-Dense ACT.
That's exactly what I figured.
Or enrolling her in the ECOG 5103 protocol.
So that's your study, evaluating adjuvant Bev with chemo. I told the doc I thought most people would use a taxane and anthracycline in a 43-year-old woman like this. But how small would it have to be to drop the anthracycline? 0.8 centimeters?
0.8 centimeters, I'm not sure I'm going to give her chemotherapy at all. And I have a hard time giving you concrete sizes because the decision is partly based on those tumor factors. It's also partly driven by the patient perceptions of risk and what toxicity she's willing to accept for different benefit.
Sure.
So in general, I would be trying not to think about chemotherapy if the tumor is less than a centimeter. But if it's a high-grade triple negative and this is someone who's exceedingly anxious about a risk of recurrence and is not troubled by acute toxicities of chemotherapy and it's, you know, 8 or 9 millimeters, would I do so? Sure. So I have a hard time trying to put up those arbitrary boundaries because there are just so many things that go into the decisions that would make me willing to behave differently.
So let's try to talk about maybe one or two of your cases here. How about your 55-year-old woman?
So this is a woman who at age 55 came in for routine mammogram, was found to have a suspicious area in her left breast, confirmed on ultrasound, and a biopsy found a poorly differentiated ER and PR negative tumor that was HER2 positive by FISH testing with a ratio of 9.2. She underwent a lumpectomy and sentinel node biopsy. By lumpectomy, the tumor was about 1.5 centimeters in maximum dimensions. Margins were appropriately negative, and the sentinel node was negative. And then her surgeon ordered a PET CT scan. I have no clue in the world why they did.
Just out of curiosity, vis-a-vis sentinel node, do you remember how many sentinel nodes were actually taken?
Three.
So you got a PET CT, or the surgeon got a PET CT.
The surgeon got a PET CT scan, which found an isolated area of abnormality in the liver with significant FGG uptake that was concerning for metastasis. And she underwent a CT-guided liver biopsy that did confirm that this was an area of metastatic disease. We retested ER and HER2 on the liver biopsy, and the results were essentially identical. No other areas of disease seen on her PET CT scan at all. She is an otherwise very healthy woman. I think she took some statin for some hypercholesterolemia, but was otherwise not on any other medications, had no other chronic illnesses at all.
So how about radiofrequency ablation and TDM1? Just kidding. Maybe in 2-3 years, huh?
You're not as far off as you might think.
Okay, so yeah, this is really tough. And obviously, she's completely asymptomatic.
She's entirely asymptomatic. Her liver function tests were totally normal. There truly was no reason for ordering a PET CT scan other than the surgeon orders PET CT scans on everybody.
You know, we had this gigantic project. It's actually posted on Adjuvant Online. We work with Peter Ravden on looking at patients with colon cancer and liver-only mets, like a huge issue to talk about. And it also made us think a little bit about what do we know about other tumors, for example, breast cancer, in terms of, you know, that kind of presentation, and you know, can these people be cured?
So our first question really is her disease potentially curable at this point, regardless of what you're going to do to her or for her? Is her disease potentially curable? Because I think that will have some impact on what treatment decisions you make with her. So, you know, we don't know, but her disease is, I would argue, at least potentially curable. We do know from a long-term follow-up series from MD Anderson of about 1,500 patients, all of whom were like this woman in that they either had stage 4 disease as they walked in the door, or they had had only local therapy at some point in the past, now with stage 4 disease. So similar in that they'd had no systemic therapy.
Yeah, but I mean, those people couldn't be made NED with surgery, most of them.
Well, I don't think we know how many could be made NED with surgery. And I don't think her chances of being cured have nearly as much to do with could she be made NED with surgery as her response to systemic therapy. Because I think it's truly unlikely that she, even at a microscopic level, has one and only one area of disease that got to 1.8 centimeters and there is not 50 cells elsewhere.
But on the other hand, you know, in terms of, quote, personalized oncology, what a weird tumor that has negative sentinel nodes and yet a met in the liver.
But that should not strike people as weird.
It strikes me as weird. I mean, in presentation,
I
can see, yeah, 2-3 years later.
Negative patients who recur.
So you think that, in other words, this lady never gets her PET scan, and 2 years later she has a clinical disease.
You know, if she had seen me from the beginning, she wouldn't have got a PET scan. I would have treated her with adjuvant HER2-targeted therapy.
Which chemo?
And some portion of these ladies would be alive and well, and we would never know. You know that the disease can spread hematogenously without going through the lymph nodes.
Yeah, you know.
If not, why would you give anybody with negative lymph nodes chemotherapy? And you saw that in the ACOSOG trial. Only 3% of patients had bone marrow micrometastasis, but you couldn't pick out who they were by looking at sentinel lymph nodes, whether you looked at it based on H&E staining or IHC staining. Clearly identified a subset of patients whose disease biologically was different. It spread in a different way. So it shouldn't be a surprise. It's not common, but it shouldn't surprise us.
Well, let me ask you, could you live with observation? Off study, particularly, I mean, is this lady, doing everything you can for me?
So we had a long chat about the MD Anderson series that did find about 2-3% of patients truly appeared to be long-term survivors, as in 10 years later, they're alive, they're well, they don't have active breast cancer. They tended to be women who were younger, who had fewer sites of metastatic disease, who weren't sick from their disease, and whose tumors were ER and PR negative. As in, they seemed to be like this woman. They also were women who had a complete response, at least radiographically, to their initial systemic therapy. So the decision over several discussions with this woman is that unless we were positive that her potential for long-term survival was zero, was just not in the offering, that we would pursue a more aggressive approach and let her response to therapy guide our subsequent decisions. And those subsequent decisions were going to include issues of what do we do with her systemic therapy? What do we do with local therapy for her breast? She's only had lumpectomy at this point. And do we do anything locally for this site of disease in her liver?
So I'm guessing she's on TCH.
She is almost on TCH. She enrolled in a phase one trial that looked at weekly Taxol and carboplatin with trastuzumab and lapatinib. It was
wow.
A four-drug phase one study. She was the last patient to enroll in that trial. She has tolerated the treatment quite well. She's had an excellent response. She has just started her sixth cycle of therapy. CT scans after cycle four showed that her liver lesion was about a 6-millimeter area that now looks like a benign cyst that the radiologist said they wouldn't have particularly noted was disease had it not been exactly in the area where the previous larger lesion was. We've had many long discussions about local therapy for her liver lesion, including surgical resection, stereotactic whole body frame radiation, RFA, alcohol injection, and she has a date with a surgeon for a laparoscopic resection of the residual area of disease in her liver after she finishes her sixth cycle of combination therapy. And at that point, we're shifting her systemic therapy to trastuzumab monotherapy.
Hmm.
And after she recovers from her liver resection, she's trotting off to radiation to complete her local therapy of her breast.
So how did she tolerate what sort of sounds like neoadjuvant Alto, sort of?
Sort of slightly different dose and schedule with the chemotherapy. There is some fatigue with this regimen, but she has continued to work. She's had some diarrhea, which required an initial dose reduction, and since then has been quite well tolerated. She's had a couple of dose delays for some myelosuppression, but has not had fevers or other complications, and has really done quite well throughout this time.
Interesting. How about your 39-year-old woman?
So this is a 39-year-old woman who I now met 8 years ago. At that point, she was 39 and came to me with newly diagnosed metastatic breast cancer. She had been diagnosed with stage 1 disease and treated elsewhere for her stage 1 disease about 7 years earlier. She'd had a 1.5 centimeter grade 1 tumor that was ER and PR, both strongly positive, like 190% for both, and HER2 negative. And lymph node negative. She was treated with unilateral mastectomy, had 4 cycles of AC, and was then on tamoxifen for 5 years. She continued to menstruate throughout this period of time and then had developed some dysfunctional uterine bleeding that was thought to be related to fibroids, for which she underwent a hysterectomy. Pathology in the hysterectomy found fibroids and no other specific pathology, but intraoperatively, her gynecologist was just looking around and found a funny area on the surface of her liver, which they biopsied, and that pathology found a well-differentiated invasive ductal carcinoma. ER and PR were still positive at 90 and 80%, HER2 still negative. With that result in hand, she underwent imaging after surgery that found 2 other small liver lesions, also concerning for metastatic disease, and some mildly enlarged mediastinal lymph nodes. She is entirely asymptomatic, has normal liver function, and no matter how hard you bludgeon her, she has no symptoms of anything.
So she's been off tamoxifen for 2 years?
She'd been off tamoxifen for 2 years at the time of her hysterectomy.
So, you know, in a way, she is somebody who, you know, if you look at this whole case, you bring up the question, I would think, of duration of hormonal therapy just as a side effect, since she got it for 5 years, stopped for 2. Of course, if this hadn't been done, maybe she never would have had a clinical problem. What do you think you're going to do right now? I mean, it's kind of like a tumor marker situation or where you pick up something that you maybe otherwise wouldn't have.
Well, this was about 8 years ago when she came to me at this point.
So we know the answer.
Well, she had conveniently just had oophorectomy.
So,
in essence, she's already started some therapy. Because if she had not had an oophorectomy and this was discovered, many people would be thinking about ovarian suppression as a potential therapy. So in essence, she's already gotten some therapy before she even gets to me. We put her back on tamoxifen after her surgery, which she tolerated incredibly well and remained on tamoxifen for about 4 years until her disease progressed.
Then what happened?
She switched to an aromatase inhibitor, was again well for about 2 years until her disease progressed, was on fulvestrant for only about 8 months until her disease progressed, and was then on capecitabine for about another 2 or 2.5 years.
Wow.
With a near complete response and feeling well. And since then, her disease has progressed much more rapidly and symptomatically.
So what's the message here?
Well, I think there is still a perception that if you have visceral disease at all, or particularly if you have liver involvement, that those are patients who need chemotherapy. And not just looking at this anecdotal case, but if you look at the literature, you find that the response rates to hormone therapy of tumors that are hormone sensitive in the liver is just as good as the response rates elsewhere. So I'm trying to get that message out that the liver and lungs don't necessarily need to have such a special place of fear in our minds, and that the treatment most likely to help someone probably is biologically based, regardless of the anatomy. This is someone who was entirely asymptomatic with an incidental finding. If she hadn't responded to hormone therapy, there still would have been ample time to move to chemotherapy with the same expectation of benefits. This is not someone who you really need your first therapy to work because you're concerned that you won't have another opportunity.
Yeah, Dr. Rummel of the follicular lymphoma fame actually is doing a trial of different durations of rituximab right now, maintenance 2 versus 4 years. And I was telling him that, you know, when Paul Goss first presented the MA17 long-term hormone data, people said, well, that's kind of like follicular lymphoma. And I was like, what? And as the years have gone on, the more analogy I see, particularly a case like this, I mean, you wonder, you know, maybe she should have had her hormone therapy continued at 5 years. I guess we just don't know right now.
Well, we don't know if continuing her tamoxifen longer would have prevented this entirely, or perhaps it might have extended her course.
Or taken out her ovaries.
We don't know if taking out her ovaries at the time of her initial diagnosis might have prevented this or might have changed her course. What I didn't tell you is she actually saw me for a second opinion, having already had a portacath placed to initiate chemotherapy.
Wow.
And had a date scheduled for her first cycle of chemotherapy within 2 days of her visit with me. And it was interesting because her first visit with me really was really jolting for her. She came to me for a second opinion, not because she was at all dissatisfied with her first opinion. As we talked about it, she realized that she had never considered that someone giving her a second opinion might give her a different opinion. It was just, this was a big deal. Everyone told her she should get a second opinion, and that seemed like a good thing to do when you're talking about these big issues. But she and her family always assumed that I would essentially tell them the same thing, and they'd feel good about it, and they'd go back home and start chemotherapy in 2 days as planned. And to have a truly different opinion, and one that was dramatically different, as much as they loved the idea of not getting chemo, was really a struggle for them and took some time for them to sort through all of the information and come to grips with how they could see two oncologists and get two totally different recommendations.
And I'm also thinking about the point at which you started the capecitabine, the point you started, quote, chemotherapy. And, you know, the capecitabine is the one agent that seems like a lot of people kind of think almost as a step between, you know, hormone therapy and chemotherapy. How did she do quality life-wise during those couple years she was on capecitabine?
She continues to work full-time. She has school-age and teenage children. She continues to be very active with them. We actually had more issues with hand-foot syndrome with her because she has a very physically demanding job.
Hmm.
And whenever she'd be working more hours, the hand toxicity would flare up. So a couple of times we had her take a full month off therapy to let things really resolve, and we adjusted her dose and schedule, but she really tolerated that therapy incredibly well.